Hello everybody and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 379. This week the questions are taken from Guide 446 to the Regia Marina's Quarto cruiser and the Wednesday video on the Spanish Civil War at Sea, as well as the Friday video which was the full compilation of the Battle of Jutland documentary series. BK Zhong asks, what do you think is the biggest reason for the underestimation of the Regia Marina in most secondary sources? Well, I think fortunately, that trend is beginning to shift, but I think actually, I know I've answered a similar question like this in a previous Dry Dock some time ago, but I think now I would actually say there isn't any one biggest reason. I think there are probably about four, and which one is the particular driving force behind a secondary source basically going, oh yeah, the Regia Marina didn't really do all that much, basically depends on the author in question. So, in no particular order, the first reason, I would say, is just conflation with the Italian army and, to a lesser extent, the Regia Aeronautica. Because let's face it, in the early part of the desert campaign, when it was just the Italians versus the British, the Italian army didn't really cover itself in glory all that much, apart from anything. One of my great uncles would have been short quite a few limbs if the Italian army in the early part of the desert campaign could shoot straight, considering he was charging around in an armoured car. Now, that aside, this is then sort of compounded by then the Africa Corps shows up, you have all the propaganda, some justified, some not so justified, surrounding Rommel and the Africa Corps, and of course the Germans in some of their reports and post-war reminiscences being somewhat disparaging of the Italians. So that kind of builds on a picture of the Italian army not being particularly brilliant. And then, even their own allies said they weren't particularly brilliant. And the Regia Aeronautica, in some ways suffering from having been pretty much the first of the big five air forces to modernize and therefore being slightly technologically behind the curve when it came to actually fighting World War II. Again, I'm sure the aviation historians will chime in and point out that the Regia Aeronautica did have some fairly competitive designs. Yes, but there weren't that many of them, as in they didn't physically produce all that many. So most of the aircraft that were being faced were, you know, half a generation to a generation behind the latest and greatest that the Allies were throwing at them, if the Allies were throwing their latest and greatest into the situation. And so this creates kind of a frontline issue with the army and the air force, where the Italians are perceived as being a not particularly brilliant armed forces and maybe a little bit technologically backwards. And then you get to the naval section and some secondary authors just kind of go, oh, well, clearly the Italian navy must have been similar to everybody else there. And take a quick once over. Did they win any massive battles against the Royal Navy? No. Okay, fine. Then they're just as bad as the Army and the Air Force. And basically, they just don't look into it that much further. Another reason is kind of related to that sort of high, very, very, very high level, almost stratospheric level overview that people sometimes do, which is major Italian naval victories. Unfortunately, in World War II, they're just aren't any. The Italians do have naval successes, but where they have something where you can say this is an unqualified success, you're not going to have someone turn around and go, well, actually, it tends to be things like Decima Mass or destroyers and actions, basically small-scale stuff, where it's acknowledged that, you know, that kind of stuff can go either way, regardless of who has the overall preponderancy, because, you know, the Japanese pull off destroyer successes against the Americans have destroyer successes against the Japanese, the same with the British and the Germans, back and forth through a good chunk of the war. So the fact that the Italians win some of the smaller actions doesn't surprise anyone all that much. And, you know, to be honest, they have some very skilled commanders, so of course they're going to win some of those engagements. But then you scale it up to the big engagements, you know, cruiser engagements, battleship engagements, etc. And while there are a few encounters where you could say overall perhaps the Italians got a strategic victory in that they managed to impede a convoy or a convoy got very heavily attacked, that requires a bit more of a nuanced look at things. Whereas if you just look at the straight up, you know, two forces of large ships came and shot at each other, who ran away, that tends to be the Italians, and where it's more of a score draw, well, it's a draw and not a loss for the Royal Navy. And so people go, oh, well, if the best they could ever manage was, you know, a draw that may or may not be a strategic victory, we can't really be bothered to look into it in all that much detail, then the primary thing you take away from it is stuff like Calabria and Cape Matapan. And then everyone goes, okay, well, clearly the Italians can't be that good because the Royal Navy is fighting them with their older ships and the Royal Navy is winning, whereas the Italians have modern ships in the form of the Littorios. Never mind that, as I pointed out in other videos and in collaboration with Italian military archives, the Royal Navy actually commits, in terms of capital ship numbers, far more of its strength dealing with the Regia Marina in 41, 42, early 43, than it ever does to dealing with the Kriegsmarine. And also the idea that there aren't the bigger, nastier, faster modern ships around is also somewhat inaccurate, because they definitely are. You know, multiple King George V class and Nelson and Rodney all at various points are standing off against potential Italian incursions. A third issue, I think, is just the fact that the Italians never really got much of a say in post-war history in terms of accounts translated into English the way that the Germans did. The Germans were relatively eager, surviving Kriegsmarine officers, to either publish their own version of events, which then either was in English or got translated into English. And people from the UK tended to, you know, go over to the German archives and to German officers and interview them a lot. So there's a reasonable amount of either German accounts or the German perspective or both circulating in the Anglophone naval sphere for quite a long time, you know, in the post-World War II environment. That doesn't really happen all that much with the Italians. And so although you do obviously get wartime propaganda, both positive and negative for the Germans, filtering down through sort of pop culture, naval history, for the Italians, pretty much everything that filters down for a long time in the Cold War and immediately post-Cold War period is almost exclusively essentially the Allied point of view coloured by Allied propaganda against the Italians, which hasn't had much of a reply, again, until relatively speaking recently in the grand scheme of things. So that I think, is actually part of the problem. If there's not a huge amount of available English language resources giving the Italian perspective, then if you're going to do a kind of a pop culture or quick reference to what the Regia Marina did, it's very easy to just go with whatever has been written in English, which obviously a lot of the time isn't particularly flattering. And the fourth reason, I think, has elements of the other three, but I think is also potentially rooted slightly in how World War II ends for the Regia Marina, because, and this definitely does lean into a little bit into prejudices and propaganda, because when you look at the Kriegsmarine or the Imperial Japanese Navy, for Western historians, especially in the immediate aftermath of World War II, which is where a lot of narratives get set, those two navies have relatively easy narrative arcs. You know, they came in, they were a threat to some degree or another, how much you want to exaggerate or underestimate that based on propaganda and what you know at the time, you know, is not really relevant to this particular question. But they set this narrative arc that the enemy navy is a threat. The enemy navy demonstrates that it's a threat, whether that be, you know, sinking of Hood or Pearl Harbor or whatever. And then we go in, we being, you know, the Western allies, and we smash them into tiny, tiny, tiny splinters, and then we overrun their home country, and all that's left of that navy is a shattered husk of, you know, its pre-war strength. You know, the Kriegsmarine has basically almost nothing above 10,000 tons left afloat by the end of the war that isn't named Prince Eugen. The Yamatos for the Imperial Japanese Navy are sunk, all their Pearl Harbor carriers are sunk. You know, there's very little of the Kriegsmarine or the Japanese Navy's surface fleet left when the Allies march into their ports. So nice, easy triumphant arc to close the story with. But with the Italians, their major involvement, because obviously there is the Italian co-belligerent navy afterwards, but their major involvement of the Regia Marina ends in the middle of the war in 1943 with a good chunk of the Italian navy still intact. In fact, at the time of the armistice, all three of the Littorios are still intact. Obviously, Fritz X's deal with Roma on the way, but you know, that's neither here nor there. And so there's not really the same kind of easy triumphant arc to close the narrative of the Allies versus the Regia Marina, which makes it a slightly more awkward subject because, you know, if we went in and we smashed the Kriegsmarine and we went in and we smashed the Imperial Japanese Navy, there's kind of the sort of Damocles question of why exactly were so many of the Italian capital ships still afloat when the Italian armistice was signed. And because that raises slightly more complicated questions, it means that, where again, when it comes to generic pop culture history publications, the authors either can't or won't really get into the details of that. And therefore, it's much easier to go, oh, yeah, well, you know, the Italians, well, they were so ineffective that they just surrendered halfway through and that was that. And moving on to the much more exciting stuff, fighting the Yamatos or something like that. So, yeah, as I said, exactly which one of those or which combination and which one's the most dominant when it comes to the historic underestimation of the Regia Marina in, you know, secondary or tertiary sources, very, very much depends on the author, because, you know, depending on their focus, depending on their level of knowledge of the area. But I think that is gradually changing, thanks to the work, partly obviously, of Italian historians who are beginning to get their stuff translated into English, plus the, you know, I wouldn't say the rise of multilingual English historians, but at least English speaking historians who are willing to use a translator here and then. And to be fair, you know, a number of bilingual Italian historians who can, you know, look at the original sources to varying degrees, get the full idea of what things look like from the Italian perspective, and then come and present their findings to the English-speaking audience, and also then look at the English language sources and compare and contrast and go, okay, this makes sense, that makes sense, these two conflict, so why is this? Okay, this source says this, but this other source from the other side, that explains that, and so on and so forth. So yeah, hopefully I think the view of the Regia Marina in the last, I would say, decade or so is undergoing something of a renaissance. Almirante Brown asks, why were the Regia Marina's interwar 120mm, 135mm and 203mm guns substantially heavier than similar calibre weapons used by the US and Royal Navies? Some of the Italian guns do have longer barrels than their contemporaries, but I can't imagine that alone explains the additional weight. It's actually quite an interesting question, and the immediate solution doesn't jump out. So let's take the 203mm or 8-inch guns as an example. So if we compare them to British and American 8-inch guns, because those are the ones that you asked for a comparison of. So in actual fact, in terms of overall gun length, the Italian gun sits in the middle. So we're talking about the 8-inch that's used on the Zara class. So the 8-inch gun that the Americans are using on most of their World War II era heavy cruisers is actually a 55 caliber. The Italian is a 53 caliber, and the British one that you find on the county class is a 50 caliber. So, you know, it's middle of the road there. The overall gun length is, and bore length and rifling length, again, it's all roughly in the same ballpark. You know, it's not particularly high or low compared to the other two guns, so nothing really to look at there. And you might think, well, hang on a minute, what about the shells and the speed that they go at? Because we know the Italian guns really, really went fast. Yes, so here's our first clue, in that the muzzle velocity for the British and the American guns, at least when the Americans aren't using a somewhat heavier shell, is somewhat slower than the Italian guns by several hundred feet per second. So that would suggest there is perhaps more energy going into things. And that is then borne out because it requires a little bit more investigation still. But if you look at the what you call the working pressure, so what is the pressure inside when the gun is fired, combined with the chamber volume, because of course the total amount of energy that the gun has to resist is a product of both of those things. Because if you can have a very, very high pressure, but if it's in a very, very tiny chamber, the overall amount of energy won't be as high as perhaps a slightly lower pressure, but a lower pressure that's being exerted over a vastly larger area. That will add up to more energy you have to resist. And while obviously at point pressure resistance is critical, if you're talking about engineering like this, it's also a case of, well, how much energy in total are we also dealing with? So now, if we go and then compare the working pressure and the chamber volume, which is obviously where the explosion initially happens, for all three guns, the British have a very similar working pressure to the Italian gun. So the British working pressure is 20.5 tons per square inch, the Italian is 20.6, whereas the American is only 18.2. So you might think, okay, well, the Italians are clearly much higher than the Americans, but they're similar to the British. But then you look at the chamber volume. The British chamber volume is a little bit over 3,600 cubic inches. The American chamber volume is just a little bit over 4,800 cubic inches, so considerably larger chamber. And the Italian is also just over 4,800 cubic inches. So we have the Italians and the Americans both having a much larger chamber on their guns than the British, but the Americans have a much lower working pressure. So what that means is that you've got the Italians and the Americans with these very large chambers, but the Italian gun is having to deal with more energy because the working pressure being exerted within that chamber is higher. And the British have a similar working pressure to the Italians, but because their chamber volume is overall smaller, there is less energy total within that chamber. So in both cases, the Americans and the British, but for slightly different reasons, there is less total energy in their chambers when those guns are being fired compared to the Italians, which is why the Italian shells are going considerably faster, because there's a lot more energy involved, period. And of course, in order for not just the breech to not explode, but also the gun as a whole to be able to take that, you need your gun to be built somewhat heavier to deal with the larger amount of energy, and therefore the gun is going to end up somewhat heavier. In fact, it is considerably heavier because the Italian 8-inch guns are, well, depending on whether you're using long tons or metric tons, but they're in the mid-20s of tons, whereas both the British and American guns are sort of 17, 18 tons around about there. Andrew Murphy asks, I was wondering if you could touch on some of the history of justice, litigation and sailors' rights when accused of misconduct or crimes, and or compare how different navies have approached this issue at different times. That's actually definitely something, now that you've asked it, that I think would make a really interesting Wednesday video, but it's also something I would have to do an awful lot of research on because, well, it involves legal stuff. And as I'm sure you appreciate, anything that involves legal stuff, laws, trials, punishments, tends to be obscenely labyrinthine-like in complexity, which, yeah, that requires a lot of unpicking. But very, very broadly speaking, for a couple of minutes here, the general trend is, of course, towards more complexity and a more structured legal system. Because, oh, and while we're actually on the subject, yes, there very much was a two-tier system during a good chunk of the period that the channel covers. It's becoming less of an issue towards the end of the time period the channel covers, but if you want to go right back to the beginning of the classic age of sail, and things get even weirder the further back you go from there, so if you go back to, say, the late Tudor period, so, you know, the late 16th century, you have this kind of two-tier system, which will persist for several centuries, which in which there's a different set of rules and regulations for officers as compared to the average sailor. But this starts off rooted not so much in a specific officer and enlisted distinction that everybody thinks about. It's more to do with the social background of those men in terms of where did they come from ashore. Because at the time, most of what you might call officers are also gentlemen, members of the nobility to varying degrees. They might only be minor gentry, but they still have some kind of title or property to their name, whereas the enlisted generally are not. And much as you at that point still have a something of a two-tier justice system on land, you get a two-tier system at sea. So, for example, when you have Drake's Round the World voyage, and near the beginning he executes Sir Thomas Doughty for basically trying to cause a minor insurrection against his command, and there's a huge amount of tension and shock aboard the ships of his fleet and back home when news eventually gets there, not just because of the potential merits and demerits of both sides' arguments and whether or not Drake went a little bit too far in accusing him of treason and mutiny, but a good chunk of the shock is because Doughty was a gentleman. And you don't execute gentlemen. If Doughty had been a regular sailor, then Drake had beheaded him or hanged him. Everyone was like, yeah, well, serves him right. But to do that to a gentleman, this must have been incredibly serious. And when it turns out that it's maybe not quite as serious as some people would have liked, it causes a certain amount of, oh, I'm not sure I approve of Drake doing this happening. And that kind of thing does persist, even though there are then certain codified rules brought in. In fact, that whole incident with Drake, in actual fact, starts to solidify the whole idea that the captain is God and you shall not question him, regardless of your social station. Although, as we saw with the English Armada expedition, that's still a work in progress during the Elizabethan times. But anyway, by the time we get into the classic Age of Sail, there is, theoretically, codes of conduct, rules that everybody has to follow. But if you are a enlisted man and you break the rules, or you are perceived to have broken the rules, then you will have rather immediate and usually relatively martial punishment. You know, it could be pay deprivation, food deprivation, flogging, all sorts of things. But, you know, it could be meted out on you pretty quickly, and judge, jury, and in some cases executioner was the captain, with maybe the support of some of the officers if they needed to assess evidence for, you know, if it wasn't so blatantly obvious that everyone had seen what had happened. Whereas for the officers, there was a whole, you know, court martial, bring them home. You know, most of the time, for most of the crimes that you could accuse an officer of, the on-the-spot punishment might be to be relieved of duty or confined to quarters if things were particularly serious. But the idea that you would court-martial an officer there and then and inflict any kind of specific, you know, physical punishment on them, whether that be, you know, flogging, whipping, or execution at sea, that man would have had to do something absolutely ridiculously terrible to merit that. You know, even people who did stuff that might actually have gotten them executed if they were general enlisted would be sent home for a court-martial to be convened at a later date because they happened to be officers and they had the protection that that station entailed. But as I said, the further along you go in time, as you get into the age of steam and steel and then into the 20th century, the more there is an effort to bring things in line. There is still something of a disparity. In fact, some would argue there possibly even still is a disparity today in some navies. But it's a much lesser one than it would have been in, say, the 1700s or the early 1800s. Warrant Officer Will asks, in your talk on the town class, the loaned wicks and other classes of US four-stacker destroyers, you mentioned that ex-USS Twiggs would be known as both HMS Leamington and HMCS Leamington. Now, I know in the latter case it's probably named after the tomato capital of Canada, famous for the old twin smokestack Heinz factory, which no longer runs and no longer has two smokestacks. However, what about the Leamington that the British Royal Navy named it for? And was this fact that both countries had a Leamington the reason that they kept its name in both services, or is it simply a coincidence that no one realised? So HMS Leamington, formerly USS Twiggs, was named after the town of Leamington Spa, nowadays styled as Royal Leamington Spa, which is a small town in the middle of England in pretty much probably about as far from the sea as it's humanly possible to get without being Heathrow Airport, which might lead you to wonder why on earth the Royal Navy was naming a destroyer for a town that had absolutely no naval connection when there's plenty of other things that you could have named it for in terms of British towns with a naval connection. And the simple answer seems to be that by the time it came to name all the town class, at least the town class destroyers, the Royal Navy seems to have just reached into its book of towns that people may have heard of, regardless of any actual maritime connection. Because when you look through the list of renamed destroyers, some, like Brighton or Bath, you think, okay, those actually do have something of a maritime connection. I mean, they at least are port cities. But then you've got places like Leamington, Buxton, best known for its mineral water, not a naval connection. Although, interestingly enough, both Leamington and Buxton are spa towns, which is why Leamington Spa is fairly well known in the UK. There's the Bradford. Bradford, definitely no real naval connection going on there. Chelsea, of course, in the middle of London. Leeds and Lincoln, both actually cities and also nowhere near the ocean. Same thing for Reading and Richmond. Richmond in West London. I used to work there, actually. Salisbury and St Albans, again, not really huge maritime connections going on there. So it was essentially, has anyone heard of this town? Yes, great, we're naming a destroyer after it. And as far as whether or not the Leamington in Canada was a happy coincidence or not, I have a feeling it was probably a case of, they've got a Leamington, we've got a Leamington, let's leave it at that. Because the track record of Royal Canadian Navy ships being renamed once they come over from British service is a little bit all over the place. It seems if there's some kind of common reference, even if it's really tangential, like, for example, Arethusa, way, way, way back. Obviously, that's a third-party importer from the Mediterranean, so it's equally foreign but equally familiar to both parties. And then where you have stuff where it's like, well, there's something called that in both countries, they seem to keep it. But then sometimes at least when there's a name that for the Royal Navy might mean something but for the Canadians means absolutely nothing, then you get a change. Of course, the Canadians also have ships built directly for them which have specifically Canadian names. But the whole, you know, has a relation to Britain but not to Canada, therefore we'll change it. Even that isn't a hard and fast rule. It's a majority rule, but not all the time. For example, HMCS Uganda. You know, Uganda being part of the Crown Colony or Fiji class makes sense why the Royal Navy would call it that when it's in Canadian service. Canada doesn't really have any real connection to Uganda other than they both loosely in World War II fall under the auspices of the British Empire. Or the Commonwealth, actually, in Canada's case at that stage. But they choose to stick with the name. Red Tob asks, what was the latest point where Britain could reliably defeat America in a naval war? Would they need to use the Anglo-Japanese alliance? Pre-World War I, Britain had a steady lead over the US Navy, but by the 20s and 30s, they were at parity with the Americans arguably being able to outbuild Britain. And by the 1940s, the US Navy had, of course, surpassed the Royal Navy. Well, I think the first thing you have to do is set some ground rules as to how do you count reliably defeat America in a naval war? Because if, you know, if we make it specifically focused on the naval war, i.e. can the Royal Navy show up, blow up at the American Navy and maintain control, let's say, of the American coastline for a decent amount of time so it can enact a blockade or something. Basically, get into a position where it could then negotiate from a position of strength, somewhat ignoring the fact that the Americans will probably go after Canada because that's a land war side of things. And, I mean, to be fair, you could make the argument that if the British can economically blockade the Americans, then you might end up with a kind of a very 18th and 19th century peace treaty of you give back Canada, we'll stop ruining your economy, which is actually basically the translation of how, minus the Canada bit, obviously, but insert territory as appropriate, basically of how a lot of treaties with Britain ended up going in that time period. Anyway, so if we define this as the Royal Navy turns around one day and goes, you know what, we're going to sink the US Navy, and they decide to toodle on over and do so. When can they reliably do so? Well, in the Age of Sail, pretty much whenever. As well, even with the War of 1812, the kind of the sea team for the most part of the Royal Navy ended up basically blockading the US Navy in port after a year or two. And by the time it was upgraded to kind of B team and a few A team ships as the Napoleonic Wars began to wind down, they really did actually lock the US coast up quite tightly. You really do not want to look at US economic figures in 1815. Prior to the peace treaty being signed, they were not good. And then pretty much throughout the 19th century, in part helped by the fact that the US Navy and the US as a whole is going through a severe period of isolationism, the US just doesn't have the ships, especially the heavy ships, to contest a Royal Navy who shows up and really wants to blow things up. The only abstraction to that point, obviously, being the US Civil War. But even in the US Civil War, although obviously the Union Navy does have a significant amount of monitors by the end of it, the Royal Navy still has a lot more general warships, and they're still on peace footing, whereas the Union's on a full war footing. And when it comes specifically to ironclads, the Royal Navy, certainly by the end of the US Civil War, certainly isn't short a few ironclads of its own, and they tend to be the really big, nasty ocean-going stuff, like Warrior. Now, could a Royal Navy contingent therefore smash the Union Navy? Yeah, if they just show up, presumably in support of the Confederacy, they could absolutely pulverize the vast majority of the Union Navy. Granted, going into harbor, i.e. littoral warfare, might be a bit dicey, purely because the monitors are better set up to deal with those very shallow coastal waters than big, heavy ocean-going craft are. But it's not like the British couldn't build their own monitors if they absolutely had to. Then fast forward into the pre-dreadnought era, still, you know, very much the Royal Navy is just so much larger. And then I think probably reliably defeat the US. Yeah, going into World War One, the US is obviously beginning to get a much more modern competitive fleet, but they still are dramatically lacking, even through the 1910s, in cruiser and destroyer screens, which, as I pointed out before, would be a huge tactical flaw and weakness in any kind of major fleet engagement, up until, of course, they start kicking out Wickses and Clemsons like there's no tomorrow. By the time you get into the 20s and 30s, it becomes a lot more questionable. Now, theoretically, yes, on paper, the Washington and subsequently London treaties do put everybody on a par, but with caveats for who's taken what in for modernization, when you look at overall numbers, especially in terms of numbers of destroyers built, number of cruisers built relative to the treaty limits and how modern they are, the Royal Navy actually is arguably, on paper, somewhat more powerful than the US Navy in every branch other than carrier aviation for a good chunk of the interwar period, simply because they're building a lot closer to their limits. And honestly, the British came out something the best of the battleship restrictions in the Washington Naval Treaty. And for the vast majority of the interwar period, carrier aviation is nowhere near as lethal as it's going to become in the World War II period. Plus, during a good chunk of the interwar period, the US has concentrated the majority of its naval strength in the Pacific, because obviously they're thinking more about facing off against Japan. So in theory, the Royal Navy quickly summoning basically its home and or Atlantic, depending on the time period in the interwar period, and Mediterranean fleets, and making a beeline over to catch the Atlantic fleet unawares, could result in a relatively decisive victory, and then the reduced strength of the American fleet, which obviously now just the Pacific fleet, has to try and fight its way either through the Panama Canal, with the British obviously waiting on the other side, or go all the way around the South America, which, well, the British will still be waiting for them, just at a slightly more open point. And the British obviously calling in their own ships from elsewhere they'd be going into the fight against the Pacific Fleet with a reasonable margin of strength. But I think when you get into kind of the late 1910s and then into the interwar period, while the Royal Navy could arguably come up with some relatively plausible tactics on how to smash the US Navy in a few decisive battles, if the US Navy chooses to give them, otherwise face blockade, the much larger elephant in the room at that point, not again accounting for land stuff, is the fact that destroyers, torpedo boats, and submarines are now very much a thing. So up until the mid to late 1900s, even with the capabilities of the very earliest submarines, borne in mind, the British strategy of either we smash your fleet now or you hide and we smash it later and we blockade your coast to ruin your economy is a perfectly viable strategy. It's been a perfectly viable strategy for centuries. Once you, though, end up against a large industrial power like the United States, and submarines actually become somewhat effective, i.e. the 1910s, just sitting off and blockading becomes a very much more dangerous proposition, and therefore much less likely as a tactic to succeed. When it comes to Germany, in actually both World Wars, Britain has a little bit of an ace up its sleeve in that obviously it can, if not necessarily fully control the English Channel, it can make the English Channel non-viable for the vast majority of German merchant shipping. And of course it can bottle up the North Sea at the far end, which again will restrict the vast majority of German merchant shipping from being able to get in. On the other hand, by the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, given that America can trade quite heavily on both its east and west coasts, those are absolutely colossal areas to cover, and there is no natural choke point in the Atlantic or the Pacific for the British to, you know, sit there and dominate away from ports where you could have sneaky submarine attacks and even torpedo boat attacks coming out every other night. So, yeah, if you want to take naval war as a whole, as I said, with the whole kind of, we've smashed your fleet and we're blockading your coast and now your economy is bleeding and crying, late 1900s, if you want to go, potentially could smash up the fleet and then something, 20s, 30s maybe. But then, of course, as World War II goes on and the British shipbuilding, has to divert more and more to repairing existing ships and building lots of smaller ships, while the US shipbuilding industry is just going, hey, let's do control C, control V on basically anything that comes down the line within reason, then the US Navy obviously goes way past the Royal Navy in terms of numbers. Vicky asks, is it possible that Billy Mitchell's bias against armour-piercing bombs could have been a result of having only low flight ceiling, thus unable to drop armour-piercing bombs from high enough to have a reasonable chance of penetrating a battleship's deck armour, low payload, and thus unable to carry significant dip bombs for a significant distance, aircraft available at the time, since an airplane that can't carry a heavy enough armor-piercing bomb high enough to make it through the target's deck armor is basically just dropping a high explosive bomb just with a very much reduced yield? I don't think so necessarily, because when you look at some of the high explosive bombs that he was lobbing at various targets and was proposing to lob at targets, they were pretty hefty. I mean, some of them weighed considerably more than the AP bombs that were being slung around by most of the capable attack aircraft in the Second World War against various ships. The US Navy was somewhat ahead of the curve in some places when it came to the AP bombs, because they were using the 1,000-pounder, and then later on against Tirpitz you have Barracudas using a 1,600-pounder and the occasional poor staggering Stuka that's had a 2,200-pounder strapped to it at the expense of somewhat shorter range and sent into the Mediterranean. But in his trials and tests, he's talking about 1,000 and 2,000-pound HE bombs quite happily and looking at even larger ones down the line. So I don't think it's the weight issue. There may be something to be said for the altitude. Not so much that the aircraft couldn't fly high enough to effectively drop an AP bomb, although obviously World War II aircraft will be able to fly higher. But I think more to the fact that for all his proclamations of incredible accuracy, I think he recognised that you weren't going to be able to go too high and maintain, you know, good accuracy. But then the flip side to that is that the armor deck thickness of World War One capital ships is substantially less than the armor thickness of World War Two era capital ships and the refitted World War One ships. So, for example, from the altitude that he is dropping his high explosive bombs, while a 1,000-pound AP bomb, which would, as I said, be about half the weight of some of the HE bombs he was carting around, while it wouldn't have the world's best armor penetration capability as compared to, you know, if it had been dropped by a Dauntless or something 20 years down the line, at the end of the day, it still would have had enough penetration to go through the armor deck of pretty much any capital ship of the period, assuming that you could get the hit. So I think his bias against AP bombs, I think it stems from three factors. One is that he genuinely didn't seem to fully comprehend exactly how to sink ships in the full spectrum of things, specifically heavily armoured ships. I mean, HE bombs, big HE bombs, which obviously he was an advocate for, to be fair, they worked perfectly fine against submarines, destroyers and small cruisers of the period. They just weren't particularly effective against big ships. And, you know, he's an Air Force officer. You can't necessarily expect him to know everything there is to know about the very specific, you know, crown jewels of another service. Another factor is somewhat related to your point about the much reduced explosive yield is just the fact that he's also quite a big showman. And so if you drop a 2,000-pound HE bomb on something, even if it detonates pretty much the instant it hits the deck, it's going to cause spectacular amounts of structural damage. Yeah, it's probably not actually going to impair the fighting capability of a battleship all that much, but it looks really impressive, and if you're in a fight for funding and who gets to be the preeminent service going forward, which is very much what Mitchell was aiming for, that kind of thing is going to make a huge impression on the civilian people who are going to be voting for whether or not you get the funding or the Navy gets the funding, far more than a little hole in the deck is ever going to do, even if the actual impact on a ship's fighting capability is much more, because ultimately if you drop a 1,000-pound AP bomb and it goes four decks down into Ostfriesland and blows a massive cavern into a machinery spaces, as impressive as that might be, you're not going to find anybody who's going to sign off and taking a bunch of civilian politicians deep into a target ship to have a look at that. Whereas, you know, drop a 2,000-pounder amidships and row up in a boat and be like, ooh, maxi big the damage. And the final element, I think, is, and this is why I say he didn't fully comprehend how to deal with battleships, is that to a certain extent, given the regimen of the tests and the ships he was testing against, he kind of was onto something a little bit with the idea of dropping a Socking Great HE bomb next to a ship and having it act like a gigantic mine, because ultimately that is actually what did in for Ostfriesland. It was a bunch of really big bombs exploding next to her and starting small leaks in her, which then couldn't be readily addressed because there weren't any damage control crews on, she didn't have power, so she didn't have pumps and everything going. You know, to be clear, the kind of leaks that those mining effects had on Ostfriesland, one, she wasn't the most modern of battleships at the time, so her torpedo defense, which would have absorbed a good chunk of the explosions if she'd been a slightly more modern battleship, obviously weren't in play. But even then, if she'd had a full crew and they were at action stations and everything closed up and been able to do damage control, she almost certainly still wouldn't have sunk with those mining effect bombs. Still, they were, again, relatively effective against cruisers and destroyers, at least as long as they're not moving. And of course, an AP bomb with much lower charge just isn't going to do that. It, you know, might spray some shrapnel and stuff, but unless it's missing by a foot, it's not going to do all that much in terms of underwater explosives. And so he probably might have thought at that point, oh, you know, an HE bomb, it'll mess the ship up really good, at least in the upper works, if I hit it, and if I just miss it, it's still going to mess it up somewhat underwater. He just failed to account for the fact, as I said, that, you know, a ship that's mobile, underway, with the damage control crews and torpedo defences, isn't going to be anywhere close to as affected by the occasional near miss by a big HE bomb as, you know, his tests would seem to otherwise have indicated. Although, you know, to be fair, you know, when you look at ships that encounter lots and lots of bombing in the Second World War, shrapnel and blast effects nearby do account for some damage that they take, particularly in small ships.
Vinve asks, the inverted bow seems to be making a comeback in warship design for the first time in a century. Could you briefly discuss the benefits and drawbacks that it has, and had, during the period the channel covers? Fortunately, since at least as far as we know, the Earth server hasn't received a physics patch in the last century, the reasons for having an inverted bow, the benefits and the drawbacks, are pretty much the same as they were back at the turn of the century. It essentially comes down to speed versus displacement and dimensions. So, obviously, if you want your ship to go faster, one of the things you can do, or indeed one of the things you have to do, is give it quite a fine length to beam ratio. But this can have a few detrimental impacts. If you have too fine a ship, it can be very unstable, particularly when rolling. And of course, every extra bit of length you add to the ship will mean more pitching, more hogging, more sagging, therefore you need a stronger structure, and of course more weight, and all of that involves more cost, which you might not want to pay for, because you might be perfectly happy with the firepower, the protection, and the machinery that you've put into actually a relatively shorter hull. So why pay for a bunch of extra volume that you are potentially not going to use? Well, with the inverted bow, as you can see with this French example, this is the Depuis du Lhomme, you just don't pay for it. You extend the bow out down at the waterline and below, which is what you need from a hydrodynamic perspective to give your ship its total waterline length, which is then compared to its beam to give you your length to breadth ratio, which, as we said, will have a very strong influence on how fast you can actually go. But as soon as you get above the waterline by any substantial margin, obviously based on what your deep load is going to be, you don't need anything above that, so you cut it back quite severely, thus saving yourself all the extra weight, volume, etc. that we all discussed earlier, and thus you get most of the benefits and hopefully very few of the drawbacks. And you might ask, well, why didn't everybody do this then? Well, turns out there are actually a few drawbacks involved, mostly to do with when the seas get rough. Now, of course, there is the fact as well that you might actually want that additional volume up front because you might want to use it to store things like aviation gasoline and paint and all sorts of nasty flammables that you have to carry, but you'd rather not carry anywhere that actually matters. And the bow deck space might be quite useful as well, especially later on when you might want to put anti-aircraft guns and so forth on. And it gives you somewhere to put your chain lockers and your anchors as well that isn't right next to your armament. But the main issue comes about when the sea gets rougher, because with a conventional bow, as the sea gets rougher and rougher and waves start to pile up and smash into the bow of the ship, a normal bow will hopefully batter those waves aside. Now, you will, of course, receive some of their impact, but hopefully you'll be cutting through it, and spray and such will be being deflected away from you. Also, if you end up in a very heavy sea and you end up plunging, then in theory the bow, which will be flaring outwards as it goes higher and higher, will provide a degree of resistance to the plunging motion in the first place, and a degree of buoyancy, or at least a reduced amount of negative buoyancy for coming back up. With the raked back bow, like you see here, all of that is inverted. So, of course, you have no real significant amount of buoyant volume above the water. So if you do start to plunge, your bow is just plunging. There's not really much to stop it. There's not much to resist it because you don't have any flare. And so in rough seas, you're very much more likely to plunge. And of course, then the extreme end of your bow is quite deep underwater, so it can take a while to come back up again. And without the braking effect of a flared bow, seas are going to come splashing up and over onto your deck quite regularly, which could be a problem. And you're also going to have, even in calmer waters, but also especially in rough waters, virtually every single wave dumping large amounts of water over the top of your hull, which is going to cause well, not just battering damage to your hull plating, but it's also going to cause drag, so it's going to slow you down quite a bit. Now, granted, if your bow does end up dipping under and the rest of your ship is bringing that bow back up, obviously the fact that it's inverted compared to a normal bow means you're going to cut back up through the water relatively easily, whereas a more conventional bow, if it's fully buried, has obviously a big flat area, the upper deck, which is resisting coming up. But at the same time, as I said, this is going to have either a negative buoyancy compared to a buoyant bow, or compared to most bows, which still have a degree of negative buoyancy, it's going to be even more negatively buoyant. So it's just not going to want to come up in the first place. You're basically going to have to haul it up with the rest of your ship. And because of its shape, it's going to end up under the water and thus experiencing some degree of friction an awful lot more than a flared bow would. So basically, if you want to optimize your ship for speed efficiency and you're only ever planning to run in calm seas, or you think you've got some other method of addressing the problems of running in heavy seas, then the inverted bow makes a good idea. If, however, you are going to run in seas that you know to be quite heavy, it's probably not such a good one, which is why most navies didn't really look into it that much. The Outer Circle asks, during the Age of Sail, trades existed aboard ships, but there didn't seem to be any officers directly in charge of their lines of work. For example, there was no Commodore of Carpentry. But in due time, skill sets such as engineers were commonplace, and with it came formal rank and recognition of service. How and at what point did this change? Now, it does vary somewhat depending on the navy, but broadly speaking, you're looking at two sets of change points. The first is kind of the middle of the 19th century, because before that, the three primary skills that you needed to have in at least some of your men would be command, obviously, to lead the ship, sailors to sail the ship, and gunners to fight the ship. Almost everything else was to a degree optional. You know, you didn't strictly need a carpenter to fight and sail the ship. You kind of did if you wanted the ship to stay afloat for any significant amount of time, but strictly speaking, to get the ship to go from point A to point B, his services weren't required, and you could kind of, if he was injured or killed or got sick, you could kind of patch in with gifted amateurs from the rest of the crew. But with the, roughly speaking, middle of the 19th century comes the steam engine. And suddenly the steam engine makes it such that there are certain people who are outside of that command, sail, shoot scenario that you just cannot get away with not having, because without the engineers, engine don't run. If engine don't run, then at best you've got a big dead weight in your ship, and at worst, when the wind turns nasty, you're going to be like all the other sail-only ships from ages past, and you might go ashore, whereas with a steam engine, you at least have a fighting chance. And as ships get armoured and heavier, of course, the steam engine becomes more and more mandatory. So, from the middle of the 19th century or so onwards, engineers and other similar trades start to get more formal rank and recognition, because, well, you kind of have to. Because without them, as I said, the ship doesn't really go anywhere. But during the latter part of the 19th century, the engineering department, and by extension a lot of the other trades, were still to a certain degree looked down upon, and a lot of the other trades kind of got agglomerated under the broader spectrum of engineering, because it was seen as kind of dirty work, not traditionally the work of a sailor, and a little bit separate from everybody else. And it was only much later on, with various social, political, and indeed naval reforms, that you get that second stage of where the engineering and trade departments get completely streamlined and smoothed in with everybody else. So, for example, in the Royal Navy, the engineering section was still a very separate section that ruled you out of any possibility of command until the turn of the 20th century. Then you had the relatively short-lived Fisher-Selborne scheme, and although it didn't last too long, one of the more knock-on effects was that it did actually bring the engineering branch up to par with everybody else who was going down the officers' courses and ranks in terms of future prospects. Now, as I say, that last step does vary quite considerably within navies in terms of when exactly it happens, how long it takes to happen, and exactly how it's integrated into overall officer training. But there are definitely two separate stages, at least in any navy that actually exists for most, if not all, of the 19th and then 20th centuries. Bob Hedges asks, regarding the barrel life of guns, how was the number of times a gun was fired known? Was there a mechanical counter like an odometer that recorded the number of times it was fired? Was it logged, or was the barrel simply inspected and when it was worn to its limits, it was scheduled for replacement? For battleship guns, the big guns, there would be regular inspections because, of course, while there theoretically would be a fixed known barrel life, exactly what may or may not be going on after a series of salvos had been fired may vary from standard. So, of course, it's very important to always check exactly what's happening with your barrels. And, of course, you could have, you know, rogue things like random bits of stuck driving band or caked on incrustations from your propellant burning and so on and so forth. So there's always going to be manual inspections just to make sure that everything is within limits and all okay. However, for the broadest spectrum of time when this actually matters, so late 19th century onwards, it's going to be all logged. Because obviously if you're firing the guns in training, then, well, you can log each salvo. But even during combat, assuming that the ship survives, it's actually surprisingly not that difficult to work out how many times each gun has been fired. Because even at absolute maximum fire rate, you're still talking about 30 to 40 seconds between salvos. And I'm not suggesting that the gun captains are going to be sitting there in the turrets while everything is going on frantically going, oh yes, okay, well, that was salvo number 42, coming up to salvo number 43 now. But if you look at various logs, like, for example, Duke of York's log for the Battle of the North Cape, you will see, or for that matter, Massachusetts' log of the Battle of Casablanca, you'll see that every salvo was logged by the ship's deck log and various other logs, and how many guns were fired, where those guns were fired from, and if any guns weren't fired, which guns didn't fire. And there would also be summaries as well afterwards. So you might see a summary that would be something like 27 salvos fired, left-hand gun A turret missed 4 salvos due to errors in drill, or something like that. But you would also see in the kind of play-by-play of, you know, 1643, you know, fired 6 gun salvo, turrets 1 and 2, this being, you know, if we're being Massachusetts, left-hand gun turret 2 failed to fire for whatever reason. And so after the battle, you could very easily go through that and go, okay, we fired this many salvos, these guns didn't. So individually, each gun is at so many rounds fired from the time it was installed on the ship. And then you can cross-reference that, obviously, with the visual inspections, how the guns are doing, and roughly speaking, how many shots you therefore have left in the guns. And you can make any necessary adjustments for immediate behavior for the next time you fire, and potentially put in for requests for new guns if you're coming to the end of your gun's lifespan. Nosdormu89 asks, in the Titanic film, while maneuvering to avoid the iceberg, Mr. Murdoch orders full reverse using the enunciator, and then when he gives the order, he does this full routine of going full ahead to full stop to full ahead to full astern. My question is, why? That seems like a waste of time. It was actually fairly standard practice for significant orders at the time on steamships, because at the time with the engine telegraph system, when you move the handle from one to another setting, and on some museum ships where their engine telegraphs are still intact, you can actually experience this yourself. If you move it from one to another, you cause a bell to ring, both where you are and wherever the other end of the telegraph system is. However, if you've got a very loud, very noisy engine room, which, engine room like Titanic definitely would be, having a single bell ring might be heard, might not be heard. However, if the instruction is really important, and to be fair, most extreme instructions are, and to be honest, even normal instructions, you probably want somebody to take notice and respond. If you, as he does, go from full ahead to all full stop, and then back to full ahead, and then all the way to full astern, you're going to be running through multiple runs on the telegraph with multiple stops, which means you're going to cause that bell to ring multiple times, which means it's much, much more likely that somebody's going to notice what on earth you're requesting. And as is kind of portrayed in the movie, if you're going from full ahead to full reverse or full astern, then that's going to take some time anyway. So the second or two that you lose by doing the engine telegraph backwards and forwards like he does, doesn't really make much odds in terms of how quickly your order is going to be carried out, but it does make it much more likely that your order is going to be carried out, period, because they're more likely to actually notice that you've asked for something to change. That is, of course, leaving aside whether or not the ship was, in fact, ordered to go full astern or was in just ordered to go to all stop, which is, you know, that's a whole other can of worms in the Titanic sinking discussion and debate, which has been ongoing for a while. HMS, and then he recites the entire alphabet, so HMS Alphabet asks, I'm curious about big cruiser guns. Only the 8-inch guns survived the Washington Naval Treaty, but what of the others, the 10-inch, the 9.2-inch, the 7.5-inch, etc.? What future would they have had if their future hadn't been curtailed by the treaty system? Now, obviously, this is just speculation, but I think the 10-inch gun probably didn't have a huge amount of future to it because, well, one of the historic problems with the 10-inch gun anyway was that it offered very little in terms of rate of fire advantage over an 11 or 12-inch gun. So you essentially were confined to battleship-level rates of fire, but you didn't get the actual armor penetration capability or the real hitting power of an 11 or 12 inch gun. It's the square cube law coming back to bite you. So I think the 10 inch gun probably would have died a death relatively swiftly. And indeed, you know, very few ships had been armed with 10 inch guns. And by the 1910s, certainly basically the only ships that were armed with them were holdovers from the 1900s. The 7.5-inch gun is a bit of a difficult one because it offers a shell weight that is double that of the 6-inch gun. It was chosen for the Hawkins class in part because they reckon it was about the biggest shell you could actually hand load, you know, with obviously independent charges and so forth. And it actually has, compared to 8-inch guns at the end of the 1910s, early 1920s, a pretty decent rate of fire. It's a fraction slower than contemporary 6-inch guns, but is considerably faster than 8-inch guns. Of course, it doesn't quite have the same range and armor penetration as an 8-inch shell, although some of that might be down to the fact that the particular 7.5 in question is a 45, whereas most of the 8-inch guns from that period tended to be 50 or 55 caliber or something of that ilk. So I can see a little bit of a competition developing between the 6-inch or near enough equivalent and the 7.5-inch or near enough equivalent, where people might be arguing, well, this advance in technology improves the rate of fire of the 7.5-inch, so it can match or very nearly match the 6-inch. At which point the greater range, hitting power, etc. of the 7.5 is better versus the greater numbers of 6-inch guns you can carry, and potentially those same technological advances allowing for even more rapid fire on the 6-inch gun. But I think the fact that with technological advances you could probably bring the rates of fire even closer together, and with the additional power of the 7.5, would probably mean that what we would later come to think of as light cruisers, the smaller half of the cruiser equation, would probably end up being armed with a 7.5 or near equivalent weapon, simply because as ships get larger, there will be a demand for more and more hitting power. And if you can keep the fire rates of the 6 and the 7.5 in roughly the same ballpark, then a lot of people will be very tempted to forego having, you know, maybe having 12 guns instead of 15 or 10 guns instead of 12 or something in exchange for considerably more hitting power. Because, of course, without the treaties, the cruisers are going to grow in size. And that brings us to, I think, probably the main winner, which is probably going to be the 9.2. Because although the 6-inch has something of a rate of fire advantage over the 7.5, which in turn has a fairly big rate of fire advantage over the 8, the 9.2 in its later versions and other near equivalents thereof is actually slightly faster firing than some contemporary 8-inch guns, and pretty solidly competitive with others. And of course, as with the 8 versus the 7.5, the 9.2 versus the 8 offers substantially greater hitting power, substantially greater range, etc., etc., the main penalty once again being weight and space required for the gun and its ammunition. So, although there might be a short period in a non-treaty environment in probably, let's say, the 1920s, at least the early to mid-1920s, maybe the end as well, where the 8-inch gun or near equivalents might be seen as the future of the big cruiser, without those treaty restrictions in place, cruisers are going to get larger at the upper end. So what we would later call heavy cruisers, essentially the big end of the cruiser equation, you know, which had previously been the armored and protected cruisers, with the armored cruisers being the big ones. Because again, once cruisers start to push 15, 20,000 tons, which inevitably they will, then they suddenly have enough displacement to support 8, 9, 10, 9.2-inch guns instead of 10, 12, 14, 16, 8-inch guns. And again, the greater broadside firepower and range and armor-piercing capability, because obviously bigger ships will carry more armor as well, will start to look very, very attractive. And because it's just shy of that 10-inch boundary where you start to hit battleship rates of fire, I think it will probably, as I say, after a bit of a lull, re-emerge as the main gun for the top-end cruisers. The Rogue Chief asks, what is the most intellectually interesting question you've encountered doing this channel? Whether it's one that made you think about it the most, one that gave you a most unexpected answer, or a question you find yourself going back to think about, or something like that. I don't think I could pin down a single most intellectually interesting question, but I can give you probably 2-3 examples of categories where that really have gotten the old brain cells working. The first would be questions about something to do with naval history where not only do I not know the answer, but I don't think anybody fully knows the answer, either because it just hasn't been written about in enough detail, or it hasn't been explored much, if at all. Is essentially, there isn't an authoritative source that you can point to and say, this is the correct answer. Because then you have to start inferring things. And of course, you do have to qualify with, well, this is what I've inferred from what I've been able to research. But it means that you are, to a certain extent, actually doing something new in the field of naval history, which is always really interesting. And it tests your research skills. It forces you to go into areas that, for obvious reasons, you haven't looked at before. And I think that is really enjoyable. Now, there's quite a few different questions that have fallen into that category over time. One that people have followed up with me, and I intend to follow up with at some point in the future, is you've probably heard a few recurring questions in recent dry docks about autism in the Navy in the 17th, 18th, 19th century before it was recognized as a thing. Without rehashing all of those questions, it's not something that's really been written about all that much, if at all. And I think it genuinely could be an interesting area of study. I'm not sure of how much use I would be in a really in-depth study of it, because, as I said, I can infer things from what I know and from what the evidence shows, but I'm not an expert in either anthropology, sociology, or indeed the medical field. So I could kind of point to things and go, this looks very much like what we're talking about, but then it's kind of over to other people to, try and work all those details out, which again will be really interesting. And I think for me, generally, I find questions which, although they're usually not of a technical nature, questions which allow you to explore how society in the time period the channel covers, whether that be early 20th century, 19th, 18th, whatever, how society dealt with people or dealt with situations in a manner that would be completely alien to our current foreign mindset, either because they didn't have a way of defining it or because their entire cultural outlook was completely different. I actually find those kinds of questions and explorations actually really intellectually interesting, because it forces you to analyze something, not just from a point of view that you may not personally hold, but from a point of view that may not be current period in society these days, not only because maybe there are people who still think like that, but they're very much in a minority, but because some of the ways these things are dealt with not just with a different set of beliefs or a different worldview, but the way that that influences an entire nation or an entire civilization set will dramatically change what happens and how everybody views things. And you cannot look at that period of naval history without considering those points of view when they come up. So, for example, with the Spanish Armada, these days it's somewhat easy to go through a very practical, these are the tactics, these were the strategies, this is all very logical, logistics, firepower, leadership, the kind of stuff we would understand in the early 21st century. But when you go back and you look at the original sources, it's very clear that this was as much a theological struggle as anything else, and who won and who lost and what happened to make them win or lose and what the final outcome meant for the people at the time was seen as much through a spiritual and theological lens of, God has judged, this side is right, this side is wrong, or at least for the people who are trying to compensate, particularly in Catholic Europe at the time, that maybe God still wants England to be Catholic, but maybe Spain has been a great sinner and therefore God isn't going to allow really bad sinners to accomplish his will. So clearly what we need to do is be even more Catholic and try again, which, to us these days, I don't know if the Falklands War had gone badly for the UK, or indeed it did obviously historically go bad for Argentina. On neither side did anyone go, what we need to do? We need to pray harder and try again. It just didn't enter their minds. But that would have been absolutely core to the thinking at the time of the Spanish Armada. And, similar things like, what constitutes loyalty? You go back even further, to be fair, not that much further, to something like the Battle of Lepanto, and you find people working for the Ottomans, who are ostensibly from Europe, people who were working for the Europeans, who are ostensibly from the Ottoman Empire. And these days, we would think of them as, traitors, sellouts, in concepts of modern nationalism. Back in those days, though, it was a lot more personal. If someone who was working for the Ottomans, they might be seen as a traitor to their country, to their nation, to their ruler, or to their faith, if they had undertaken actions that people viewed as traitorous. If, however, that person had, say, offered their services in their particular skills to a particular ruler, and the ruler had said, go away, I'm not interested, and they'd taken those, their livelihood, their skill set, to another ruler who just happened to be the Ottoman Sultan, and the Ottoman Sultan had said, yes, I will pay you large amounts of money and get you to work on introducing this whatever it is to my fleet. People at the time were like, fair enough. He did the right thing by offering it to his people, quote unquote, first. If they said no, well, what's a guy to do? Some people would obviously still think he's a traitor. Some people say, maybe he should have gone and offered it to this other ruler. But most people were like, what did you expect? You should have been smarter. He did what he needed to do to stay alive. Again, very different concept to what we would think of today in those terms, but very, very current to what they thought. And anyway, I did promise I'd give you more than one example. So other intellectually interesting examples would be why, but why in connection with things that are relatively commonly known and broadly agreed with, because a lot of the time, not all the time, but quite often, you'll get things that are broadly known and people just kind of accept that because there is a certain amount of self-evidence to what is being said. So, for example, the idea that British destroyer captains in World War II, especially, were a bunch of mad lunatics who probably would have been locked up in asylums if they hadn't entered the Navy first. And the Navy had concluded that destroyers made really good floating asylums and kind of point at enemy and release and try not to get in the way. Now, you can point to any number of British destroyer captains' actions and go, there's your proof. It's pretty hard to argue with. But then people say, why? You know, can we also show this via hard data? And that's just one example. But, you know, there's all sorts of, if you like, tropes, but ones that are based in fact. But asking why and going deeper into that, you know, what exactly made this happen? Why did the Royal Navy, in this particular example, select the slightly unstable captains for this duty? Why did those people actually end up being attracted to that kind of duty? Did any other navies do this? How did they, you know, filter these people down? What are the advantages and disadvantages? You know, going into the weeds of something that is otherwise relatively easy to pass over at a high level, that I find quite interesting. And I think the other big one, which I kind of look at it and go, ooh, I like that one, is when people say, ah, could you tell the awesome story of this ship? Now, in part, sometimes, like, say, Warspite or whatever, or Enterprise, everybody knows that's got an awesome story and it's a privilege to tell it. However, while those are really cool, the ones that, to a certain degree, are actually even better to, in a way, and I hope you'll understand what I mean when I go forward, is when people ask, could you tell the story of this or that ship when this or that ship really actually isn't well known at all? And you have to chase down really weird and obscure sources to find out, did this ship actually do anything interesting at all? But when you do find those sources and you go, oh, wow, no, this really does need to be told. And then you tell the story and then people are like, whoa, I didn't even know this ship existed, let alone that it did these cool things. Now, of course, usually there, if there are, you know, sources available, there's some small core of people out there somewhere who did know about it. But being able to bring that to a much wider audience, I think, is one of the things I find really interesting, in part because of the, you know, the deep exploration and finding of sources and putting together a narrative and working out which bits of narratives are reliable and which ones probably aren't. That I find really interesting. So, you know, videos like The Voyage of the Glorioso, you know, there's probably a decent number of Spanish people interested in their own naval history who knew about the Glorioso, but I can absolutely guarantee you that the vast majority of the English-speaking naval history enthusiasts probably didn't, or if they did, they knew about it in passing. And so being able to tell that story after having to go through an awful lot of searching for appropriate sources, that was actually really fun and interesting. And with that, I thank you very much for listening, and it's time to bring this episode of The Dry Dock to a close, and I hope to see you again in another video at some point soon in the future. Bye for now.